Welcome to the Blackbird Review Podcast, an audio showcase for the literary talents of students at Clayton A. Bowden High School. This is episode 6. I'm Ilyan Medarov, and we're coming to you from blackbirdreview.org. Hello and welcome to the Blackbird Review Podcast, episode 6. As Clayton A. Bowden's writing group, the Blackbird Review is dedicated to inspiring creativity and providing a stage for students to express themselves through writing. Today, we'll be discussing some of the recent works produced by students in our school, and providing you with a snippet of our recent interview with Mr. Young. To start, we will be reading Jason Zeliff's Consider the Kit Kat, an essay looking behind the curtains at what we dismiss as a simple Halloween treat. Let's take a look. On every October 31st in the United States, New Zealand, and most of Europe, children go out, dressed up as their favorite football player, monster, or Disney princess to knock on people's houses and say, "Trick or treat," only to receive candy from these kind homeowners. As I grew up in Voorheesville, New York, I always loved the night of Halloween. I would meet up with my friends in costume. We would go from house to house, seeing how much candy we could get before people started to get angry because we were ringing their doorbell at 10 o'clock. Then we would gather up all our candy and compare and trade it for our favorites. Mine was the Kit Kat bar. For as long as I could remember, the Kit Kat bar has always been my favorite candy. The chocolate outside and the vanilla wafer inside. It put two great things together to make a perfect combination. I loved its texture, the crunch it made as I bit down, the chocolate flavors mixing together with a crunchy texture created sweet and delicious bar. Once I discovered that there were other varieties like white chocolate, dark chocolate, and mixtures such as mint and dark chocolate, my passion only grew. I started looking on the Nestle store, looking for all the ways to eat and enjoy Kit Kats, which only led me down a rabbit hole even more. There, I discovered recipes for Kit Kats, brownies, ice cream cake, cheesecakes, tortas, and more. My thirst for this pleasure was relentless and my appetite unending. What these discoveries have done to me may have steered my life in an upward spiral to more and more new ideas for my novice palate. This newfound desire led me to try and go to the source itself and recreate my one and only necessity in this world. While trying to scour this web for Nestle's secret formula, I stumbled upon something about how they were made. Thin sheets of vanilla wafers got funneled into a large oven to be baked to perfection. Then, the wafer sheets are transported to an area where a layer of cocoa-based syrup, straight from Côte d'Ivoire, is poured. Then another wafer is put on top of that, creating a sandwich of chocolate and wafer. It is replicated once more, and under extremely delicate procedures, sliced into their desired outcome. They are finally coated in a special type of chocolate that was created to be cooled down and shaped into a perfect-sized bar. To create these rectangular masterpieces, I realized I must research the sources, which led me to learn about their cocoa production in the beautiful Côte d'Ivoire. Upon researching the suppliers to Nestle, the Côte d'Ivoire stood out to me. As in July 2022, Nestle retracted from their fair trade policy and changed it to a sustainability differential policy. This, at first, doesn't seem like too big of a deal. As I looked further into it, there's quite a big difference. Fair trade policy is one that the Côte d'Ivoire cocoa farmers have always been thankful for, as in recent times, there's been a price collapse in cocoa. This has spelled disaster to many of the farmers, as the average cocoa farmer makes only $2.40 a day. But thanks to the fair trade policy that was in place, many of these Côte d'Ivoire farmers have had some safety during this fall in prices. However, because of Nestle's change to the sustainability differential policy, the farmers are not paid the same premium as the fair trade policy agreement had given them. This follows the trend in the past couple years, where companies like Sainsbury, Cadbury, and Tesco all canceled their agreement with fair trade as well. But this isn't the only ethical problem that Nestle has had in the recent past. It isn't subject to arguments over false advertising, aggressively stated that its formula for babies is better than breastfeeding, which had caused many infants to die unnecessarily. Along with other issues that have come up regarding taking Native Americans' water from its already scarce quantity due to droughts in recent years, is to act beyond the boundaries of ecological protection and basic human dignity. All these arguments have led to a rather uncomfortable question. Should we be buying from unethical companies for gustatory pleasure? Although these companies have done these arguably unethical actions, is there anything that can be done about it, and can people like us put a stop to it? After looking at all these facts and having a long discussion with my stomach and these companies that have engaged in unethical activities regarding them suppliers and others around them, I hope that whoever reads this can also think to themselves before making the choice of whether to get sick from the candy that is given out in copious quantities this year, and make the decision for themselves to refuse the candy that is not ethically sourced. Jason brings some light to the unethical practices of companies that you wouldn't expect from them. If you were to guess what companies were harming workers' livelihoods, your first thought probably wouldn't be a chocolate company like Nestle. Nonetheless, these injustices exist and aren't recognized by many people, leading many to continue supporting the companies without knowing the full picture. Writers like Jason help unearth these things, allowing people to choose whether they see these companies as unethical or not. Overall, a great essay from Jason Zeliff. Now let's move to the fiction side of writing with Ali Sapienza's Yesterday's Drive. The last thing that I want to be doing on Halloween night is babysitting my little brother. However, according to my parents, there's no way for me to get out of this. I have been threatened to be grounded, have my phone taken away, lose my allowance, never see my friends again. Pretty much any privileges I have under the sun will be lost if I refuse. I'm supposed to be at my friend's house right now for a party, but I'm here instead, sitting on my own couch and watching the Charlie Brown Halloween special with my brother. I look over to him and notice that he isn't even paying attention to the TV, so I roll my eyes and hit the power button on the remote. "Hey," he whines, looking up from his paper and crayons to the black TV screen. "Why'd you do that?" "You're not even watching it, Henry, so who cares?" I stand up and walk into the kitchen, half-heartedly doing the dishes that my parents told me to do. "But I was listening, Abby," he groans. "How about you go to bed," I say, wiping off a plate with a washcloth. "I didn't even go trick-or-treating." "I can buy you candy tomorrow. Just go to sleep," I roll my eyes again. "But I wanted to go." I throw my washcloth in the sink and turn to face him. "And I want to go to my friend's party. So I guess Halloween didn't work out for either of us." Henry looks at me for a second longer before storming off into his room. Finally, I can have some peace and quiet. I walk to the living room and pick up some of the popcorn and snacks I was eating, when I noticed the drawing Henry was working on. I pick it up, seeing that he drew a picture of me when we were sitting on the couch. But chills run down my spine as I get a closer look. There's someone sitting next to me. It is only the two of us here, and there was definitely nobody on the couch next to me other than him. But the worst part is that the person he drew, the little girl, looks familiar. She had the same black hair I remember, but in this drawing, she has blood all over her face and body. She is wearing a white dress. I cover my mouth out of shock as memories of yesterday come back to me. I run to my brother's room, carrying the drawing as I knock on his door. "What?" a sad voice responds. I open the door to see him sitting on his bed reading a comic. "You drew this?" I ask. "Of me when we were watching TV?" "Yes," he says slowly, like he's confused as to why I'm so distraught. "Why?" "Who is?" I turn the picture around, pointing to the drawing of the girl next to me. "This." "What do you mean?" "What do you mean, what do I mean?" I laugh nervously. "Who is that girl?" "She was sitting right next to you," he responds, looking at me like I'm the crazy one. "Did you not see her?" My eyes widen and my mouth falls open before I begin running through the house, frantically throwing open the doors to every room we have, searching for any sign of her being here. "Abby, what's wrong?" Henry shouts to me from his room. "Nothing," I shout back as I pull back the shower curtains in our bathroom. "Stay in your room." After checking every room and confirming that nobody is here, I walk back into the living room, attempting to stabilize my shaking hands. Suddenly, the TV turns on all by itself, and I jump at the sound of it, releasing a small shriek. At first, the TV is still playing Charlie Brown, but then it switches to a news channel. 7-year-old Adelaide Miller was reported dead this morning after a hit-and-run took place last night. Police are still searching for the person responsible. My breath quickens as I feel guilt in my throat choking me. The screen then shows a familiar face, one that will be ingrained into my brain for the rest of my life. The same face that is drawn on the piece of paper in my hands. I run to the couch and grab the remote, quickly turning the TV off. I spin in a circle, surveying the room once more, feeling like I'm somehow not alone. After a moment of complete silence, I jump at the sound of my doorbell. I quickly walk to the door, dropping the drawing my brother made on the floor. I glance out the window first, seeing a bunch of kids in costumes. I roll my eyes and open the door, only an inch as I peek part of my head out. "Trick or treat!" the group yells in unison. "I don't have any candy. That's why the porch light is off," I say before slamming the door shut. When I turn back around, I notice that the drawing I dropped on the floor is gone, and chills run up my spine. I slowly round the corner into my kitchen, when I notice a piece of paper stuck to the fridge that was never there before. I walk closer to get a better look. It's the drawing. It looks the same as it once did, only this time, I have blood all over me, and the little girl does not. I slowly back away, knocking into my kitchen island when the doorbell rings again. I let out a frustrated groan. I speed walk to the door, tearing it open. "I said I don't have any—" I stop talking when I see that there isn't anyone at the door. I poke my head out, looking to the right and left of my porch, only to realize that nobody is there. "Trick or treat," a voice says behind me. I quickly spin around, coming face to face with the little girl, the one that was pronounced dead. The one I am responsible for killing. The last thing I see is a little girl's smile, and the last thing I hear is my screams. Despite starting in a classic horror setting, this story strays away from the cliches and incorporates some real-life problems. The slow rise in tension is well done, starting with the drawing and moving towards the eventual ghost reveal. The clues hint at the hit and run the protagonist committed the day before, slowly unraveling the story for the reader and leaving them with a few interpretations of the end. Was the story about how guilt can rack the mind? Or was it about a vengeful spirit returning to haunt their shameless killer? Ali Sapienza really managed to combine all these elements into a phenomenally told horror short story, pulling the reader into the mind of the main character. We've had some great submissions to our issue this year, but we've also had many students within our group working hard, especially with a recent interview with Mr. Young, a hard-working and contributing teacher in our community with a creative musical pastimes. We'll provide a quick snippet here on today's podcast of a few interesting questions. Let's look into his life. So to start, when did you first start having an interest in music? Mr. Young replies, saying, "As a kid, I played piano and took piano lessons and loved it, and started writing my own songs on piano, so probably in late elementary school." Mr. Young clearly had his ambition to start early, but I wonder why. For the next question, they asked, "So was your interest in music influenced solely by seeing it in school and learning it in school, or was your community or your household also heavily involved in music?" Mr. Young responded with, "My father played jazz piano, not professionally, but he did play it out sometimes. It was more of a hobby for him, so the house was constantly filled with the sound of jazz piano, which I guess kind of programmed me to like music." This certainly explains why he was interested in music from such a young age. They also asked, "When did you first think to include your skills and playing guitar in your teaching? I know you talked about how you went from that acoustic rock to just mimicking and copying songs. When did you start creating your own? When did you start thinking, oh, I can include this in my teaching?" Mr. Young responded with, "Right, so I think probably around the late 1990s or 2000. For a solstice party, remember the solstice parties? Mrs. Barcher wrote a bunch of earth science holiday songs because she actually used to team teach earth science with us, and I just had fun taking known songs and adding earth science lyrics. It just like rhymes, and I like finding words that go together and, I don't know, get a little thrill out of that." So what was before I even learned guitar? And then when I learned guitar, you know, I wanted to write a hydraulic cycle song, so I did Puff Puff the Magic Dragon. It just kind of changed the lyrics for that. So that was probably, let's see, late 2000s into 2010. I started writing earth science songs, and then I started making my own music too, like Topolov. Remember that this is just a snippet, and the full interview can be found on our website, so make sure to check it out and to read more about what makes Mr. Young who he is. And that's it for another episode of the Blackbird Review podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. The Blackbird Review podcast is a production of the Blackbird Review and the Voorheesville Central School District. It is produced by Leon Medarov. Our intro music was written and performed by Sadie Goldfarb and Sophia Golodi. All of the stories heard on the podcast and so much more can be found on our website, www.blackbirdreview.org. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.